Okay, welcome back. Today, we will study the notion of particle and how many particles we have, so the particle number operator, and then we study the notion of no particle, the vacuum. So notice that an important decision is to be made by what we mean by the word vacuum. And what we mean by the word vacuum in cosmology is the state without particles, if there is such a state. It doesn't automatically mean the lowest energy state, even though it might seem that these are the same. Today we will find out that the lowest particle number state and no particle state is not the lowest energy state in general. So we will call the vacuum the no particle state. Okay, so let's start by reviewing the notion of particles and particle number. Remember from last time that there are many different mode functions, sets of mode functions that we can use to solve the quantum field theoretical problem. And so we can write the field chi in any number of ways using creation and annihilation operators A and A dagger and mode functions V. And if we use just one choice, we might call them A and A dagger and V. If we also consider another choice, we might put tilde on the Vs and on the A and A daggers. So there are many of these choices. But on the other hand, we know that the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation is only two complex dimensional for every mode. And therefore, every other choice of mode function other than the initial one, the Vs and the V star, that we might come up with by some means, any other choice has to be a linear combination of V and V star, because if V is a complex valued solution, then V star is a complex valued solution. And if it's complex valued, these two are not linearly dependent of each other, so they form a basis. So every V star is a linear combination with generally complex coefficients of the V and the V star solution. And then remember, we also had a condition, and it comes up later again, on the alpha and the beta coefficients, such that if V obeys the Wronskian condition, the condition that's needed to make sure that chi obeys the canonical commutation relation, the alpha and the beta have to obey a certain condition so that V tilde then also obeys that. And the condition is, of course, you know, alpha squared minus beta squared, I mean modulus alpha squared minus modulus beta squared is 1. Now, from the fact that the same field can be expanded one way or another way or yet another way, from that fact, we obtain by using also that the other mode function can be expanded as a linear combination of the first mode function and its complex conjugate, we can substitute the V tilde expression into here. And you see that we then obtain an expression that only contains the V and the V star, and the V and the V star here. Then that we can use to collect everything that's proportional to V star over here, and everything that's proportional to V over here. And that allows us to relate then the A tilde operators to the A and A dagger operators. And if you put that in there, please do that as an exercise, you find that you can express the A operator in terms of the A tilde operators in this way. A is alpha star A tilde plus beta A dagger for each mode. That's the key equation that allows us, as we discussed in the previous lecture, to calculate the unitary map from the basis that is generated by using the untilded A and A dagger operators to the Fock basis that is spanned by using the tilded A and A dagger operators. Namely, we do it this way. We know that the untilded A on the untilded vector 0 is 0. And that equation we can now express using the reformulation of A in terms of the A tilde operators. So if you obtain the equation that these quantities here with the A tilde and the A tilde dagger acting on that untilded 0 vector is 0, then we make an ansatz for that untilded vector 0 as a linear combination of the tilded basis vectors. And then we can solve that recursively, and we obtain that the untilded vector 0 is this expression, a two-mode squeeze state, in terms of the tilded quantities. And from that, we can then also express not only the vector 0, but also the vector A dagger acting on 0 and A dagger squared acting on 0. And so any basis vector of the untilded basis can be expressed then also in terms of the of the tilded quantities. Every time we act with an A dagger operator over here, we use this formula. So A dagger is, you know, the Hermitian conjugate of that. And then on the left, we act with an A dagger. On the right, we act with this expression. And so everything is always expressed in terms of the tilded operators. And we said that we will make use of the different ways of writing this, having in mind a scenario where at an early time the vector 0 might be chosen to be a vector of interest, namely the actual vacuum state at the early time. And then at a later time, we might choose different mode functions with a different vector 0, the 0 tilde, which we choose such that at a later time, the 0 tilde corresponds to or is the vector that actually at that later time describes the vacuum state. And in this way, we can calculate particle creation as we discussed, particles being created in pairs. But we have not really discussed yet how to identify which vector in the vectors in the Hilbert space is actually the vacuum state at a given point in time. Now, in preparation for that, let's look at particle creation, because we will define the vacuum state as a no-particle state. So our equation T up here shows that if this is the early vacuum state, and that's the late vacuum state, and this, therefore, is the state of the actual quantum field, because it started out in that state and we are in the Heisenberg picture, then it means that later we have lots of particles having been created in pairs. And in fact, any number of particles might have been created because the exponential contains arbitrarily high powers of the A daggers. So there's a finite probability for finding any arbitrarily large number of particles, as long as that number is even. And so it could hypothetically be that this interferes so much with the evolution of the system that our assumption, namely that we just have a background space-time on which a field is evolving, might break down. In principle, particle creation could be so strong that it contributes so much to the energy-momentum tensor that the energy-momentum tensor that is created by this feeds back onto the evolution of the curvature, so that what we initially assumed is the evolution of space-time isn't anymore. So in principle, that could happen. So let us calculate the expected number of created particles. For this, we need the usual definition of the number operator from quantum mechanics. If you have a harmonic oscillator, then you usually define the n hat operator to be A dagger A, the number operator. And why is it called the number operator? Well, because it's a self-adjoint operator, therefore it's an observable. And if you act with it onto a state that's an n-fold it's the nth excited state of a harmonic oscillator, then you get back that state, but with the prefactor n. So the eigenvalues, the spectrum of the number operator is the natural numbers. In quantum field theory, we have a number operator for each mode. So we have n hat k. And then the sum of these number operators is the total number of particles. So let's see, how would that be interpreted then in quantum field theory? So let's say at some time eta, the state is the vector zero. And let's assume that that vector zero is the vacuum. And in that case, for example, that state where we applied n times the Heidegger operator, notice that it's not normalized. You have to divide by square root of n factorial in order to make it normalized. But that's not that important here. So this state is then a state with n particles of momentum k. Now let's assume that it's not that easy, and let's assume that at eta the system is in an arbitrary state omega. Then how do we calculate what the expected number of particles is of momentum k? Well, as usual, the expectation value of an observable is given by state left, state right, and the observable in the middle. So let's calculate that in the case up here. For this case. So if we have this state here, then what do we find for the particle number? So at late times, the number of particles is measured by measuring the observable n tilde k, right? Because at late times, the vacuum state, the no particle state, is the state 0 tilde, which is annihilated by the operator A tilde. And then the one particle state at late times is Heidegger tilde, acting on 0 tilde, right? So the number operator at late times has tildes on it. And it's made out of these A tilde and Heidegger tilde operators. And that omega is the state that the system is in, such as the untilded vector zero. A remnant, because of the Heisenberg picture, of the fact that we assume here that the system started out at early times in the state zero untilded, which might have been the vacuum state at the time. So we calculate for the state that the system is in what the number expectation value is at late times. So what we have here is, by substituting the expression for it in here, is A tilde dagger A tilde. And this is the state that the system is in. It's the untilded zero. Now we know how to express the A and A dagger operators in terms of the tilded ones. We did that at the very beginning of the lecture today. So all we need to do is to solve that for the A tildes in terms of the A operators. That's a simple thing. You express A this way, then you take the Hermitian conjugate, then you can express A dagger in this way, and then you just solve these two equations for the variables A tilde and A tilde dagger. And that's the result that you get. So A tilde is this combination, this linear combination of the A's. So now that's ready to be substituted in here, and also the Hermitian conjugate of that. When we do that, this is what we obtain. So I just took the A tilde and replaced it by the expression in terms of A, and here as well. And we do that because we don't quite know how the A tilde is actually acting on the untilded zero. The untilded zero is not annihilated by the A tilde. So we could either express the untilded zero in tilded quantities, or we leave it as it is and we express the tilded A and A daggers in terms of the untilded A and A daggers. And that's the strategy that's easier. So let's do this one. Now we have everything in here expressed in terms of A and A daggers acting on the untilded zero. Everything is untilded. And that's great because it means we can tell right away that this term goes away. Everything that involves that term goes away because here we have an A annihilating that vector. We also know that everything involving that term goes away because the A dagger annihilates to the left. So therefore, the only term that actually survives among these four terms is the one with the A dagger, right? Because this one is not annihilating to the left, and that one is not annihilating to the right. But A dagger, we can rewrite using the canonical commutation relation as A dagger A minus 1, plus 1, right? A dagger is A dagger A plus 1. So what we obtain is this prefactor, that prefactor, this and that prefactor, the two betas, and then that's from using the commutation relations, writing A dagger as A dagger A plus 1. And we do that because then we get another A here annihilating that. So only the 1 actually survives the whole thing. And therefore, we obtain that result here. The expected number of particles of momentum k at late times is given by the modulus squared of the beta coefficients. This is super important that the alpha coefficients are not involved. In general, you can get Bogoliubov transformations left and right. You just change coordinate system, you get Bogoliubov transformations. Even if you just do a rotation, you can view it this way. Because, you know, what used to be an A dagger K in one direction, after you rotate, becomes an A dagger K in a rotated direction. You get a Bogoliubov transformation. It will only involve alphas. In order to have particle creation, you need Bogoliubov coefficients, beta. If the betas are non-zero, you get particle creation, otherwise you don't. So not every Bogoliubov transformation is capable of creating particles, only the ones where betas are involved. And remember, the betas are the ones that mix the daggered with the undaggered. Right? If you had no beta coefficients, then A's would go into A tildes would go into A, that's all. Typically what you would get with a rotation. But if beta coefficients are involved, then A and A daggers mix. And that makes all the difference. That's how you can get particle creation. All right, so that's the expected particle number for one mode. Now for all of the modes together, we simply sum this all up. And if we sum this all up, then we get the sum of all the beta coefficients moduli squared. Now, let's look at this again. There's an important point that I skipped over, which is that the commutation relation between the A and the A dagger is actually containing on the right-hand side a Dirac delta. And therefore, that shouldn't be a 1. That should be a Dirac delta. And when we evaluate that there, it's an infinity. So yes, it would be the modulus of the beta coefficient squared, but multiplied with Dirac delta evaluated at 0. Now, but we do know how we can arrange for this to be a 1 rather than a Dirac delta. It's an infrared cutoff. Right? Then we get a discrete set of k values, and then we get proper commutation relations that have a Kronecker delta on the right rather than a Dirac delta. But what's the physics of the difference between the two? Any guesses? Why would an infrared cutoff be super important here? Well, imagine we find that particles get created. Right? There's a finite probability for particles to get created. And at the same time, we assume that the universe is infinite in size. Well, how many particles would that mean that are being created? Right? If the particle density that's being created is finite, and you multiply it with an infinite volume, you get an infinity right away. And that's the zero that you would get from the Dirac delta there. I mean, the Dirac delta of zero being infinite. But that would tell us so little. Because it would mean we have infinite number of particles, no matter what the density of particles is. Right? The lowest density, the highest density, medium density, multiply with infinite volume, you get an infinity. So therefore, it's much more informative to actually take a finite volume, infrared cutoff, and then you can work out from that what the actual density is, the volume, and then here these coefficients. Okay, so that was an infrared divergency here that we got. In general, the difference between the Dirac delta and the commutation relations and the Kronecker delta regularization is an infrared issue. Okay, so having used a box now, having used the box implicitly here, because we are summing over these, I mean, we just chose discrete values of k because we can, because we put the whole thing in a box. We got a finite value here. And then we sum up, instead of integrating over all k, we have to sum over all k. And then we have a chance that this is finite. And this would be the total number of particles in the box. Now, of course, that still doesn't guarantee that it's finite, this number. Every individual number is finite, but the series doesn't need to sum up to something finite. However, we have to be careful, because we have to insist that the energy of all those particles sums up to something finite. Here we're just summing up the number of particles. For the energy, right, that's different. Here you have to have h bar omega times the number of excitations, and then sum that up. And this omega is, of course, calculated from the k vector as square root of k squared plus m squared, and the generalization of it here in curved space. So we don't really mind if that comes out infinite. But the energy should not come out too large, especially not infinite. Because if it did, it would mean a contribution to the energy momentum tensor that strongly, perhaps even infinitely, back reacts on the gravity. But so far in our formalism, we have always assumed that the scale factor, the A of eta, the scale factor, the evolution of the space-time, is a given background evolution. We are assuming that the quantum field, no matter what it does, is not going to interfere with that preordained evolution. Later, of course, we will have to come back to this because, yes, the quantum field will be able to back react on the evolution of the space-time in a very important way. Namely, the quantum fluctuations will imprint themselves onto the curvature of the space-time through that interaction, ultimately through the energy-momentum tensor. Now, you may wonder, okay, if the energy comes out finite, we make sure that we keep our model realistic by making sure that the energy comes out finite or even small. Doesn't that usually also imply that the particle number is finite? Any guesses? What do you think? Does it usually come out finite or not? There are actually two situations. They're very different. If the particles in question have a mass, such as electrons or Higgs particles or so, then you get a finite number. And the reason is that if you have a finite energy budget and every particle comes with a certain minimum amount of energy, namely the rest mass energy, E equal mc squared, then you can only have so many particles. Your energy budget doesn't account for more. However, if you're dealing with a species of particles such as photons or Klein-Gordon fields without a mass, then in principle, with even the tiniest of energy budget, you can afford to buy any number of quanta. Right? Because even an infinite number of particles can sum up to have a finite amount of energy if the amount of energy that each particle carries as you count them goes down fast enough. And that happens all the time. Like when you shake something charged, this could be your own hair. If you shake something charged, then that comes out as infinite. the number of photons that you create is infinite, because they are in principle being created at arbitrarily long wavelengths, therefore at arbitrarily low energies, you get an automatic infrared divergence. It's not something to worry about. If you put your system into a finite box, well then there is no minimum energy due to an E equal mc squared, but what you then have is that there's a minimum energy because there is a small, there's a longest wavelength that there is, and you can't make the wavelength any longer. There's only one exception, which is you could have periodic boundary conditions and then a constant field that doesn't cost you any energy. But it's not believed that periodic boundary conditions are realistic. If they were, it would actually overthrow much of what's going on at in gravitational quantum physics now. Because it's, for example, believed that black holes represent the density, the highest density of information, of entropy that you can have for a given amount of energy. But if you had true access to massless particles, well, then you can encode any amount of information at an arbitrarily small energy budget, way more than a black hole could, right? So it's believed that you can't really have access to zero energy particles, as in zero modes. Okay, I'm just saying that if you do quantum electrodynamics in Minkowski space and you calculate that for just accelerated charge, yeah, it's going to be infinite.
We had the two-mode squeezing transformation, right?
Yeah.
And typically, if you have two-mode squeezing in a partial trace, you get a thermal state. I'm wondering, is when you look at the photon number, or number of particles, sorry, in one of the modes, is it a thermal distribution?
I don't know that by heart. I'd have to look into that. I don't want to say yes or no on that. Work it out. Okay. I don't know.
Well, it just relates to if there's thermal. Is it related to expansion or contraction?
No, it's not. It's not a Planck distribution. No, because you can tell what the distribution is, right, for every direction, and it's not a Planckian. The Planckian would go up polynomially, and then it would have an exponential decay. I don't think it's that. But I have to think about this a bit more. Okay, so now we are ready to start the big investigation here. What is the vacuum state? How can we identify in the Hilbert space of states the state which, at the moment that we are interested in, is describing the no particle state? Once we find out which vector that is in the Hilbert space, we would like to choose our mode function such that the corresponding vector zero happens to be that vector. Okay, so how can we identify the state vacuum at time eta? Remember, we used the conformal time, so that's why I call it eta. And remember, vacuum means the no particle state. Is that state one of those states, the zero tilde, zero double tilde, whatever? It turns out, yes, if there is a vacuum state, and there's no guarantee that there is one, but if there is one, and in FRW spacetimes usually there is, then we can actually express it in this way. But that means that then there exist mode functions for which the corresponding vector zero or zero tilde, is that vacuum state. So that's what we want to do. We want to identify this state, and that means we want to identify that mode function whose corresponding vector zero is the vacuum state. In fact, we will go one step further. Remember, we want to identify the vacuum state in the Hilbert space. I mean, we pick a time, right? Because we have to ask the question, which state is the vacuum state in principle at every time afresh. Just because we found out what the vacuum state is, which vector in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state now, doesn't mean that this tells us what the vacuum state is later. We have to explore at every time separately which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum state. Now, we want to describe the vacuum state as one of those vectors zero, with or without a tilde. The point is, as one of those vectors zero, and that means we describe the vacuum state by specifying a mode function, namely the mode function whose A operator is annihilating this. But in order to specify a mode function, remember, we do not need to specify the entire behavior of the function everywhere. The mode function is a function of k, but also a function of time. And the mode function, therefore, can change over time in wild ways. We do not need to care what the mode function does at late times. If all we want to know is if all we want to do is pinpoint the mode function. And the reason is that the Klein-Gordon equation tells us all of the evolution of the mode function if we know its amplitude and its derivative at one point in time. So in particular, this means that to fix a mode function at one point in, I mean, at all points in time, it suffices to know its amplitude and derivative at one point in time. You see, this means that to specify the vacuum state at a particular point in time, you only need two complex numbers. Right? In order to specify the vacuum state at the time eta, all you need to know is what is the mode function, whose vector zero is that state. But in order to specify that mode function, you just need to tell what is its amplitude, one complex number, and what is its derivative, time derivative, the other complex number, at time eta. That fixes the mode function at all times. So the choice of vacuum is a choice of two complex numbers, that's all. So let's see how we can find out what they are. So we notice to specify a vacuum state by specifying a suitable vector 0 is equivalent to specifying a suitable mode function v. That is to say, a suitable mode function v which obeys the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition. And that is equivalent, specifying a mode function is equivalent to specifying at one point in time, let's say at the time eta, what the amplitude is of the mode function, let's call this r, and what the time derivative of the mode function is, and let's call that number s. I mean, it's mode dependent, right? So it's rk and sk. So choosing rk and sk is to choose a mode function, is to choose a vector zero, is to choose a vacuum state. So to identify the vector in the Hilbert space, which qualifies as the vacuum vector, will be done by trying to identify these numbers r and s, where an overall phase will not matter. Right? So if you put an overall phase in front of the v, it's still the same mode function. It will not make a difference. It's just like in first quantization, if you put an overall phase in front of a wave function, it doesn't matter. And the same here, an overall phase doesn't matter. All right, so to identify the vacuum vector is to identify two complex numbers here. And the first attempt should be the simplest possible thing. Let's just see whether we might get away with assuming or with trying the ansatz that the vacuum state might be the lowest energy state. Why not? Let's see what goes wrong if we assume it. So let us try to define the vacuum state as that Hilbert space vector which minimizes the Hamiltonian. What that means is that we will choose these numbers, R and S, the initial conditions of the wave function, and therefore the wave function. We will choose these numbers, and that means we choose a vacuum state, a candidate for the vacuum state. We choose these numbers such that the corresponding vector 0 is the lowest energy state of the Hamiltonian. That's something concrete that we can calculate, right? By choosing R and S, we get different vectors 0, and the expectation value of the Hamiltonian for these vectors depends on what we choose for R and S. So now we will just plug that in there and then choose our R and S such that the vector 0 that we get is the lowest energy state. Let's see. All right, so we take the vector 0 that is determined by choosing R and S, that is to say, choosing a mode function, getting the corresponding A and A dagger vectors, and getting the corresponding vector 0. So the vector 0 has these R and S's effectively built in. Okay, so we calculate the energy expectation value now. So here, expectation value. And here we have the Hamiltonian of the chi field. If you remember, it's just the second time derivative, second space derivative, and all of the magic is built into the time-dependent mass. I wrote it here from the original perspective where everything was still in co-moving positions. But then it's a small exercise that, again, would be good if you did it, if you have the time, to plug in the Fourier transform. So to express your field in terms of its Fourier transform. So you express chi of x in terms of chi of k. And then the chi of k, remember, can be expanded in this way with the mode function. Plugging all of that in here, so you do the Fourier transform, and then you expand the Fourier transformed field in terms of mode functions and creation annihilation operators. Then you obtain that this turns into that, where we have all these terms here corresponding to these, where all of this was defined to be the omega. So what we have here is time derivatives of the mode functions and omegas. And omega k's. The omega k is defined like this. From the Fourier transform, these space derivatives become a k squared. So the omega contains this and the k squared from there. Well, and we get these terms. And as it should be, because we get chi quadratically in here, right, here quadratically, we get, because the chi is written in this way, we get squares of this. So we get terms with a squared, terms with a dagger squared, and then a dagger and a dagger a terms. And here they are. This is the a dagger squared terms, the a squared term, and this is the mixed term. Now that term goes away right away because the a dagger annihilates to the left. And the A annihilates to the right, so this one goes away and that one goes away. And here the A annihilates to the right, so that goes away, and we're just left with this. If we have one half here is a quarter, and that's the only thing that's left over. So we've now expressed the expectation value of the Hamiltonian in terms of the mode function. I mean, this is the expectation value of the Hamiltonian at a certain time, the time that we want to identify the vacuum state. Let's call it eta 1 now. We've expressed the expectation value of the Hamiltonian at time eta 1 as a function of the mode function's amplitude squared and the mode function's time derivative squared. These two guys are those numbers here, the R and the S, right? So this is the R, no, this one is the R squared, and that's the S squared. So that means, in order to minimize the energy expectation value, in order to minimize the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, all we need to do is to minimize that expression here by choosing the R and the S coefficients as small as possible. Now you might say, well, I choose them zero. How about that? Right? And then the energy would be zero. Why can't we choose R and S to be zero? Remember, there is an equation between phi and phi prime, between phi and its time derivative. It's the Wronskian condition, right? The R and the S are not free. They have to obey the Wronskian condition. And that means that, well, here it is. It will come up in a moment, but let's go this way. Let's do it systematically. So the energy expectation value, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian is given by that expression. And we identify now this as R modulus squared, and this is the modulus of S squared. And we need to determine now these R and S coefficients. Once we figure out what to choose for R and S, in order to minimize that energy expectation value, we're done. Because it means knowing R and S, we know the initial conditions of the mode function at eta 1. And the Klein-Gordon equation gives us the mode function at all times. And so we have the solution at all times. And we have, in particular, the A and A dagger operators. And we know that the vector that's annihilated by the A operator is our guy. That's the thing that we want. That's the vacuum. If we identify the vacuum with the state that has the lowest expectation value of the Hamiltonian. So let's see. Here again is the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. It's this expression, the same thing as what we had up here. It's this. Now we use the definitions for R and S, and then we can write the energy expectation value at time, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian at time eta 1 for this candidate state 0 in this way. We want to minimize that expression, but we can't set S and R equal to 0 because we must have the Wronskian condition. Otherwise, the commutation relations wouldn't hold. So we remember that S and R are actually V prime and V, and V prime and V obey this condition at all times. So in particular, at time eta 1, and therefore the S and R coefficients obey this condition. So we can't choose S equal to 0, because then the left-hand side would be 0. We can't choose R equal to 0. No, we have to find some compromise here. So what we will do is, we will do that with a constraint minimization procedure. We want to minimize that expression subject to this constraint. So we want to minimize the energy expectation, that's this expression, and then that constraint needs to be implemented. So we put a Lagrange multiplier here and then put the constraint in there. So what we have to solve now is ds by ds star equal to 0 and ds by dr star equal to 0. And we obtain from that this equation and that equation. Let's just check if we differentiate this with respect to S star. So we differentiate with respect to that. We get an SK, that's this one. And then we differentiate with respect to S star here. We get a lambda RK, that's this term, equal to 0. Okay, ds by r star, that gives us omega squared r. And then differentiating with respect to r star gives us a lambda sk equal to 0. So we get these two equations. If instead we differentiate it with respect to the uncomplex conjugated quantities, we would just get the same equations, just complex conjugated. In addition, we need to remember that the constraint must hold. Now, I leave it to you as an exercise to solve that problem. The solution is quite easy. And what we obtain is that Rk has to be 1 over square root of omega times some arbitrary phase. And Sk has to be I times the square root of omega times the same phase. So that's the solution to this little extremization problem. We can choose this arbitrary phase. That's just a phase in front of the mode function. It doesn't matter. And we can choose this arbitrary phase to be 0, for example. So what that means is that we found our coefficients R and S. We found out that if we choose that mode function, which has this amplitude at time eta 1, and that time derivative at eta 1, then, I mean, that those two coefficients, of course, determine the mode function at all times. Then the corresponding vector 0, the one that's annihilated by the corresponding operator A, is actually minimizing the energy expectation. And we are conjecturing that this might be the vacuum state. So what we do is we use these initial conditions, define then the mode function at all times from that, obtain that vector 0, build our Hilbert space basis, our Fock basis on top of that, and we assume that the lowest energy state that we obtain in this way is the vacuum state, and yeah, that would be the natural thing to do. Let's see if that is at least correct in the Minkowski space case, where we know how to do the quantization. Well, Minkowski space is the special case where the scale factor is 1 and stays 1. The space-time is not expanding or shrinking or anything. So that's the Minkowski space case. In that case, the frequency is k squared plus m squared. And if you look at, where is it? Further up, over here. So in the case of Minkowski space, A is always 1. So it's just k squared plus m squared. And there is no acceleration, so the A double prime is 0. So it's just that, k squared plus m squared. Also, the conformal time in Minkowski space is the same as the proper time, as the cosmic time. So then we conclude that the vector 0 is the state of lowest energy at time eta 1 if we choose the mode functions which obey these two conditions that we had there. Where are these? Yeah, these, right? So we said R is 1 over square root of omega, and S is I times square root of omega. So the amplitude at eta 1 is this, and the time derivative is that. Now let's see, what mode function do we get? This is the initial condition. And the Klein-Gordon equation of Minkowski space tells us how that solution continues forever. So all we need to do is solve the Klein-Gordon equation on curved space, on Minkowski space using these initial conditions. And the solution is obviously this one. And it is also obviously the one that we had at the beginning of the course. We just recovered that. So again, I leave it to you as an exercise to find, to check that this mode function, 1 over square root of omega, and then this phase function here, which is at eta equal to eta 1, this is just a 1, that this mode function is actually the mode function that we found at the beginning. Also, if going back to our FRWL space times, if we wanted to find out by the same method what the vacuum state is at a later time, then we would go through the exact same procedure, and we would again conclude that the amplitude of the mode function has to be this with some phase, and the derivative would have to be that with some, with the same phase. And that means that if nothing changed, like in Minkowski space, nothing changed, you find that these conditions are obeyed by the same mode function at all times. Therefore, in Minkowski space, you find that you get the same mode function every time except for an irrelevant phase that's absorbed up here. Right? If you just continue, if you take this mode function that you discovered at eta 1, you use the Klein-Gordon equation to propagate it forward in time, then of course it has some phase acquired most of the time. At some points in time it's real there, but most of the time it has some phase. Now, if in some other time you go through the same procedure and you look for the mode function again, then you have that criterion, and then you find the same mode function but a different overall phase in general. It's not important, but let's just keep that in mind. So since we obtain in Minkowski space always the same mode function, we always obtain the same vacuum state. And therefore, in Minkowski space, no particles get created out of the vacuum. The same mode, I mean, this mode function obeys that condition at all times, just for different phases theta at different times. But now, here's the downer. You see, it all looks good, right? We have a good criterion, a solid idea, and it matches what we know from Minkowski space. But let's see. Our ansatz was that at an arbitrary time eta 1, the vacuum state, the no particle state, can be identified as the lowest energy state, the state that minimizes the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. But this means that we are committing to a prediction. We are committing to the prediction that when the universe expands and the Hamiltonian changes, that the vacuum state might be a different one at different times, and therefore that we have particle production in general. Not in Minkowski space, but as soon as we have expansion, we should get that. And in a much more elaborate calculation, where you're working not with the chi, but with the phi field, and not just the phi field, but also with fermions and gauge bosons and so on, you can estimate how much particle production that would be in a universe as we see it. And the production rate that you predict in this case is too high. The production rate would be about 10 particles per cubic kilometer per year and per species. You might think that's not much, but the thing is that we have on average only about 10 to the 9 particles per cubic kilometer. So if this had been going on for billions of years, basically all of the matter and more than we see would have to have been created in this way. There's too much of it. In fact, we see no evidence at all of particles being just popping out of the vacuum like this today. So the conclusion is that the universe is evolving a little too much for this to be a viable identification of the vacuum state. The vacuum state should probably not be identified in this way, because otherwise it's in contradiction with observations. We don't see as much particle creation as would be predicted in this way. So that means we have to go back and reconsider what we mean by the vacuum. Now, the usual argument goes this way. Usual argument goes phenomenological, essentially, saying that, well, we don't see particle creation during the expansion of the universe now. Since the expansion of the universe is slow, it's not as dramatic as it probably was during the initial period of inflation. Since it is slow now, maybe we should expect that there is no significant particle creation on the grounds of a comparison with what happens with the harmonic oscillator. Imagine you have a harmonic oscillator, and you change its parameters. Remember, gravity is not externally driving, it's parametrically driving. And you change its parameters, but you change its parameters slowly. Like the frequency parameter, you change it, but you change it slowly. If you do it slowly enough, then the harmonic oscillator may change its frequency, but it won't get excited. If it started out in the ground state, it might stay in the ground state. If you just do the change slow enough. But what is slow enough? Slow enough is slow as compared to the actual frequency of the harmonic oscillator. If the frequency of the harmonic oscillator is omega, roughly speaking, what we mean by slow is that you change the frequency slowly as compared to the frequency itself. The frequency sets the time scale, and the change of the frequency sets the time scale. If you do that, then you are in a so-called adiabatic regime. And the idea is that we identify that state in the Hilbert space as the vacuum state, which is the most stable under adiabatic evolution, meaning that it's that state which stays the same state, now talking in the Schrödinger picture, which stays the same state under adiabatic evolution. It's almost the same as the minimum energy state, but it's slightly different. It's basically saying that when you have a harmonic oscillator whose frequency is not fixed, but you change it over time, you might move it up, you might move it down. You change the frequency of a harmonic oscillator over time. Then it's kind of naive to say, oh, at this point in time, the ground state is this one. Because what do you mean by the ground state is this one? In principle, you could just diagonalize the Hamiltonian, find out what the lowest energy state is. This is what we just did. But what does it actually mean? Because the harmonic oscillator doesn't even have a full oscillation usually, or while it does an oscillation, the frequency changes underneath it. The nature of the harmonic oscillator changes while you try to determine what its ground state is. So what we will do is we will identify that state which is the most stable under the adiabatic evolution. How can we do that? Well, let's consider a simple model. We will free ourselves from its constraints in a moment. Let's consider a simple model where the universe is initially a Minkowski space, and then it starts undergoing an expansion which is slow, that is to say, adiabatic. In this case, we expect no particle creation. Or we would expect a lot of particle creation, in fact, too much particle creation, if we were insisting on the idea that the vacuum state is the lowest energy state. But instead, since that's observationally not consistent, we say, well, maybe the no particle state should be the state that is most stable under the adiabatic evolution.
Question. In Minkowski space, we don't have this problem, right?
No, we don't.
Just set it as the zero, the lowest energy state, and we don't have to worry about this. So this is only when we don't.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. See, personally, I think there is another way to look at this criterion, which is, let's go back to what we mean by the vacuum state. By the vacuum state, we mean the state of no particles. And we want to maintain that definition while the universe is expanding. And then we can ask, well, which state is stable? There's only one state that is stable under the expansion and could qualify as the vacuum state there, and that's the state that has no particles. Why? Because a state with particles in the expansion would have that, those particles diluted away, so that the density of particles would go to zero. Only the state that has no particles to start with would have that just stays as it is. So it's sort of a stable fixed point.
Is that guaranteed to exist?
No, there is no guarantee that such a state exists. That's right. In general, I don't know. Well, we come back to it, actually, for the case of Friedmann, Robertson, Walker, Lemaître spacetimes. But for generic spacetimes, there is no reason for this to exist. The spacetime could expand here and contract there. It could do all sorts of crazy stuff. And there is no reason to think that there is an observer for which there are no particles, and for which there's a state. There's no reason to think that there's a state for which there's an observer thinking that there are no particles.
Does there have to be like a global notion of a vacuum state?
No, that's the point. Globally not. Globally for sure. Not for generic curved space-time. Locally. But even locally, if you confine something to a space, then you must have momentum uncertainty, because you have, where things are. You must have momentum uncertainty that gives you energy uncertainty. That typically translates into particle number uncertainty. Not in an experimentally significant way, right? If you have a giant box, then it's not going to produce particles right here. Okay, so let's assume space-time starts out initially in Minkowski space, and then it starts undergoing an expansion that is slow, it's adiabatic. And we are looking for a state that's stable under that, that doesn't create fresh particles. And I think that's very natural, because under the dilution that expansion does, we would expect that the stable state is the state without particles. So the vacuum state should always be essentially the same Hilbert space vector under adiabatic evolution. Then when the evolution becomes non-adiabatic, sure, all bets are off. But what we are after here, even though this is a kind of a global consideration, a long time consideration, Minkowski space and then adiabatic slow evolution, what we're actually aiming at is this. Imagine the universe does all sorts of capricious things, but at some time interval, it's approximately adiabatic. At least in this case, we want to be able to identify what the vacuum state is. So while the universe has a phase of adiabatic evolution, during that phase, we would like to be able to identify what the vacuum state is. It's actually going to be even a little more complicated, because what is adiabatic and what is not can depend on the mode. Because some modes have large k, short wavelength, high frequency, and others have low k, long wavelength, and slow frequency. Right? And that matters in the question of adiabaticity. But we will see. We're just talking about one mode now. And for one mode, we can always decide whether or not it's adiabatic, as we will see in a moment. Okay, so if we are looking at one mode and the time evolution is adiabatic, then we would expect, and that's the important part, that whatever criterion we come up with to identify the vacuum state should give us the same state in the Hilbert space at all times. Because no particle creation. That means the same vector in the Hilbert space is the vacuum vector. Because that's how we get, otherwise we would get particle creation, right? Particle creation happens if we identify the vacuum state now, and later we find out, oh, it's another state that's the vacuum now. That's when we have particle creation. We don't have particle creation if our vacuum identification criterion always points to the same vector at all times. That means no particle creation.
As long as we're in the Heisenberg picture?
Yeah, well, you can also translate that into the Schrödinger picture. So how can we find that state? What we need is a state. We need that vacuum state. We need, therefore, that mode function, which is singled out by a vacuum identification criterion at all points in time. As long as the evolution is adiabatic, our one universal vacuum identification criterion applied at any point in time always gives us the same mode function, and therefore always gives us the same vacuum, and therefore we are not predicting particle creation. Okay, so remember we started with Minkowski space and then we launch some adiabatic evolution of the space-time. So we know what the mode function is at very early times. That's why we chose Minkowski space, because we know what the mode function there is. So we know it at very early times when the universe was still Minkowski. Namely, the mode function is this one. Now, that mode function we can use as the initial conditions now. So we pick some point in time very early on, and that gives us initial conditions. It gives us an amplitude and a derivative. Right? The amplitude is 1 over this, and the derivative is I times square root, because you get an omega down, right? Okay, so we can use it as the initial condition, and then the Klein-Gordon equation tells us what happens to this mode function at late times. At late times, it won't be just that, because the universe is actually expanding. It's slowly expanding, but it is expanding, and that will be reflected in the mode function. And it's already determined by knowing this, because this tells us what the mode function does at early times, and then the Klein-Gordon equation at early times is trivial, but then the Klein-Gordon equation becomes non-trivial, because it picks up on the fact that the universe is now adiabatically evolving. And so this thing is adiabatically evolving, and we will soon see how it is adiabatically evolving. Namely, like this. So if we take that solution, and we consider it at very early times, when the universe was Minkowski space, well then, there was no time dependence in the omega, and that is this. And at really early times, when there was no time dependence in the omega, well, then the integral from eta naught to eta is just eta minus eta naught. So this becomes that, this becomes that. So during the Minkowski phase, that's the same, right? But here we have the time dependence built into it throughout the adiabatic evolution. This thing has a little flaw, which is that it's not exact. This is not the exact continuation of that. You may wonder, why don't I write down the exact one then? Well, it's because nobody knows. For that, we need to know the scale factor, A of eta. The A of eta scale factor goes into this. We need to, the actual evolution of the Klein-Gordon equation. And then you could, in principle, find corrections to this. But this is already an excellent approximation to this. In particular, it is what is called the adiabatic approximation. In the approximation where the evolution is slow, this is, in that approximation, the solution. Now, let's see what that approximation actually entails. So the adiabatic approximation is the approximation in which the evolution of the space-time is slow enough so that the change in the frequency of a mode, so omega prime, is small, which is to say that this number is small compared to 1. Now, if I just wrote this, it would make no sense. Because if I take a frequency and differentiate it with respect to time, then I get something like 1 over t squared, 1 over seconds squared. I could make this huge. I could make it small just by changing units, right? So that makes no sense. So instead, what I need to do is I need to divide it by some other quantity that has units 1 over seconds squared. And that's the frequency itself. So this is uniquely the quantity that you can write down for the first derivative that makes it unitless. You're comparing the change of the frequency to the frequency itself. So that's the first slow roll condition, namely that the rate of change of the frequency is small compared to the frequency, but also that the acceleration, see, we have second order differential equations, so we need two conditions. Also, the acceleration we want to be small compared to the frequency itself. And here we need the third derivative. Oh, this doesn't look like a 3, but it's supposed to be a 3. So that's also small. Under the condition that these two are fulfilled, so any terms that contain this or that can be neglected, then that is an exact solution, as long as we can neglect these and these terms. So just take that V of k and eta and plug it into the Klein-Gordon equation. Assume that these vanish and find that it obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. Now, what we want to do is we want to identify the mode function vk whose corresponding vector 0 is the adiabatically defined vacuum state. In other words, we want that mode function here to point us to the vacuum. It's the A operator that corresponds to that V that annihilates that vector 0 that we take to be the vacuum state at all times while there is adiabatic evolution. Now, as we discussed earlier, we want to be able to identify the vacuum state in principle at any time. We cannot assume that the universe does us the favor of starting out in Minkowski space and then evolving adiabatically forever. It can do capricious stuff, and it probably did. The evidence is very strong that it did. And ideally, we would like to be able to identify which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum at any time. At least if it's a time in which we have adiabatic evolution. So we need a criterion which, at least during adiabatic evolution times, points us to the right vacuum state. So it must, at least during periods of adiabatic evolution, it must single out that wave function here. I mean, not wave function, that mode function here. So what we are looking for is a criterion that we can apply locally in time, at one point in time, at some point in time when we want to know which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum. We need a criterion that we can apply at one point in time that will point to this wave function there. And always the same one, right? So we need a condition that this wave function, this mode function, obeys at all times. And that condition is this one. It's the initial conditions that we can impose at any given time that we choose. And we can compare that now to the condition that we had earlier, namely the lowest energy attempt to the attempt to identify the vacuum state as the lowest energy state. So first of all, what's the amplitude? Well, the amplitude at any given point in time, choose whatever eta you want, the amplitude is 1 over square root of omega times some phase. That's some phase, right? So it's e to the power I theta, and then that that prefactor that matters. And what's the time derivative of it? Well, the time derivative now acquires not just an omega from differentiating here with respect to eta, we get the integrand down. No, we also get a term from the time derivative of the omega here. That's the difference. That's why we get two terms here. We get the term that we already know from the minimum energy attempt to identify the vacuum. It had the I omega divided by square root of omega, so that was the square root of omega in the numerator. That's the term that we already had. And this term is new. That one arises from differentiating this with respect to eta, where we get another 1 over omega here, and then omega prime. And then again, the phase is the same phase as here. So what that means is that we can switch from the naive idea that the vacuum state is the state that minimizes the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. We can upgrade that to a vacuum identification criterion that has the benefit of not predicting particle production during adiabatic evolution simply by adding that term here. Right? That's the only difference to the previous criterion. If we drop that term, this is the same as just saying that it's the minimum energy state. And when does this term matter? Well, it matters if the omega prime is significant. Of course, it can't be too significant because then we are out of the adiabatic regime. But it's characteristic that without that, there's no derivative of the omega involved. But the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion knows about the derivative. So now we know how to identify the vacuum state at any time, at least during adiabatic evolution, but it's also used when it's not necessarily adiabatic. What you do is you say, let me look at what the omega k is doing. And then from the omega k, at the time that I want to identify the vacuum, the omega k of eta is a given function, right? Remember, it's a k squared, and then it has an m squared, a squared term in it, and it has the second derivative of the a in it, and so on, right? It's the omega is the thing that can go imaginary and all that. So we know that function explicitly. And if we want to know which vector in the Hilbert space is the vacuum vector at time eta, the idea is we take the omega k and we calculate that, 1 over square root of omega k. That's the initial condition for the amplitude of the mode function. And then we also calculate that expression here, and that gives us the initial condition for the derivative of the mode function. The Klein-Gordon equation allows us to complete this into a mode function for all times. It comes with A and A dagger operators, and the A operator annihilates a vector, and that's the vector we take to be the vacuum state. It's a state that we would have arrived at earlier or later. Also, as long as there was no non-adiabaticity in between. But weirdly, of course, this means that the vacuum state is a little bit elevated over the lowest energy state. Because it's not the lowest energy state, so it must be elevated. Okay, so this is just what I said in words. Consider an arbitrary time, eta 1. Could be early time, could be late time. And we assume that the evolution is adiabatic, as adiabatically slow for the mode k in question at around the time eta 1. And then we identify that state as the vacuum state, that is to say, as the no particle state. We identify that Hilbert space state as the vacuum state, whose mode function obeys these initial conditions. And then we call that so defined vacuum state the adiabatic vacuum state. Those were the conditions, just to remind you, those were the conditions with a naive lowest energy condition. And remember, it's very similar, right? Because this is omega divided by square root of omega, so that's that term, and only this one is new. For generic curved spacetimes, no analog of these criteria is known and probably don't exist, at least not if the spacetime is really generic and has all sorts of stuff going on at the same time. Also, let's remember that whether or not the evolution is adiabatic at a particular point in time can depend on the mode that we are considering, because the omega k depends on the k squared. So we might be, for sufficiently large k, the omega k is always real, right? But it can go imaginary for small k. So things can change quite dramatically as you go from small wavelength modes to large wavelength modes. And therefore, in principle, one has to decide these things mode by mode. Okay, this is it for today. Questions? That was a tough one, right?